Welcome back to the FKT podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today we're chatting with John Kelly. John is no stranger to the FKT scene, having set many FKTs, as well as finishing the infamous Barkley Marathons. He's been on the show before, but today we're going to chat about his recent supported Wainwright's FKT in the UK, as well as what the FKT scene is like in the UK and his future plans. So let's dive in. Hi, John. Thanks so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to chat for a bit.
I know you're in the midst of acclimatizing for Hard Rock and a big move back across the ocean, so I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, of course. We just arrived in Leadville last night, so I might have to stop and catch my breath every now and then as I'm talking to you.
Yeah, it's a little higher in elevation there than it is in England.
Yeah, I think I was at like 16 feet where I lived in England.
Yeah, as somebody who grew up at 75 feet, I understand. Yeah, it's like hard to fathom sometimes when you go to the mountains. So obviously, I mean, you recently returned to the U.S. after several years in the U.K., and I just thought we'd start out maybe talking a little bit about the FKT scene there versus in the U.S., because obviously you're kind of in this unique position having done multiple FKTs in both countries.
Well, first of all, this is something I've mentioned to Buzz before, but there's a little bit of pushback in the U.K. on the term FKT to begin with. And so I think when Buzz and Peter Bachlin, they came up with this FKT term, it was legitimately, there were all these routes that they had no idea who had the fastest time on them. The best they could say is that this is the fastest known time. In the UK, there is a very rich tradition going back many years on a lot of these routes. And it's also much more concentrated. Obviously, it's a smaller country. There are a smaller number of more significant routes. And so they very much know what the fastest time is. And they are very assertive in using the term record rather than FKT on some of these routes. But yes, it's a very rich tradition that has an amazing amount of support around these efforts, whatever you would like to call them. And it was exciting to be a part of that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And not too surprising that there would be variations in other countries on what they are called. I think that's really neat that there's like a longstanding tradition and getting to be a part of that. It's always very fun to be part of something that there's a legacy to. So while you were in the UK, you said several FKTs, but your most recent one is the one I kind of want to focus on today. And that was of the Wainwright's 214. And I think that a lot of our listeners might be US based and they might not know, first of all, what that route is or understand maybe what things like rounds and fells are. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about the basics and also the Wainwright's route itself.
Yeah, so the Wainwright's are a set of peaks. Well, peaks is a loose term here. It's 214 tops in the English Lake District, which is where the Bob Graham Round and a number of other big English challenges take place. And they were 214 of his favorite viewing spots. And so most of the time, those are peaks. Sometimes they're slightly off of the peaks where he felt there was, a better view looking in one particular direction. It's a lifelong goal of many walkers and hikers in England. And it was first done as a continuous round over 3 decades ago at this point. Alan Heaton and Joss Naylor, two of the legends of fell running, did it. And it was really revived back in 2014 when someone plotted out, Steve Birkinshaw plotted out the best route of doing this, of connecting these tops in one continuous go. And it's seen various improvements on this over the years, both in time and in the route itself. Is one thing that I found is quite exciting that I loved about fell running and running in the UK in general is how much of it is freestyle, and that there's not these defined trails. It's run along this trail or run along this route, and that's exactly where you have to go. It's I need to hit that peak and that peak and that peak, and it's completely open access, just open terrain that you get to choose the best line between each of them, and even between people, between weather conditions, that can vary quite a bit. So it adds a big element of creativity and another bit of complexity to it.
That sounds similar to me to the kind of the way that Nolan's 14 is usually approached here.
Yeah, definitely.
And so what exactly is spell running?
It's really the term given for it in that area, the English Lake District. In Scotland, they're more fond of the term hill runner. It's quite similar in both ways, where again, you have these huge, vast areas of open terrain and open access land where you're allowed to freely explore it. And so it is going from peak to peak to kind of hit these checkpoints in whatever way you feel is the fastest. And so it can vary quite a bit from the sort of thing like the Wainwrights to these very hard and fast races, which are exciting to see. I'm a bit disappointed I never got to participate in one, largely thanks to COVID, but people just absolutely bombing down these descents out there in these the mountains that are lower elevation, but they are quite steep and quite challenging.
Yeah, I enjoyed looking through your photos from your Wainwright's trip, and it definitely did look like challenging terrain in some of those areas.
So the Wainwrights itself, it came out on my watch and another person that did it recently to 350 to 360 miles, mm-hmm. somewhere in there, and about 120,000 feet of elevation gain. And when you look at most challenges in these areas, that's comparable to what they are for every, 60 miles or every 100 kilometers, you might have 20 to 25,000 feet of elevation gain. And then on top of that, the thing that is rather unique compared to the U.S. is the terrain, having to deal with bogs and other features that really I had no comprehension for what a bog was before I came to the UK. And then also highly volatile and unpredictable weather patterns. I've certainly seen more extreme weather in any one direction, but the speed at which the weather can change, particularly the wind, can be extremely difficult to be prepared for and to deal with when you're out there.
All things that can really up the challenge of anything you're doing. So what would be your top bog traversing tips, or bog avoidance tips maybe are better, like that you learned?
Well, first you've got to look for the kind of neon green looking algae on the ground. That's normally a big indicator that there's a bog there. You don't want to step on that because they can disguise themselves and look like just normal ground until you step and sink up to your chest and have no idea how to get out. If there is one there, then finding tussocks, the big clumps of overgrown grass, those can kind of provide sort of stepping stones to get across. You're still going to get wet and filthy, probably up to your knees, but you at least hopefully won't sink and get stuck in there.
Right. Don't want to end up like the bog people that they dredge up from time to time.
Yeah, I mean, there have been stories of entire tractors sinking into these things.
Crazy. Yeah, we don't really have that in the U.S. at all. Since you mentioned that this is like kind of an open-ended terrain and methodology, did you design your own route for the Wainwrights, or did you follow a route that other people had done?
I mainly followed that original route that Steve Birkinshaw put together, which was just an enormous undertaking on his part. He lives in the Lake District and just trying to optimize the best route between 214 peaks. That's difficult to do on the road, much less out in the mountains. And so from that, Paul Tierney broke his record a few years later, made some minor improvements to the route. Sabrina Vergy broke Paul's record, made some minor improvements to the route. So I had the information from their attempts. Sabrina was extremely supportive and provided me with her data and her information on her route. And so I made some minor tweaks on that I felt was better suited for my own preferences and running style. And went with that.
Yeah, the amount of logistical preparation to like come up with that route is just mind-boggling. Like, studying that, like as somebody who does a lot of peaks and has linked things up, like it's difficult to do. And on that scale, it's just incredible. earlier you mentioned the distance and the vertical ascent for the route. And I feel like that's pretty next level for most ultra runners. And so I'm kind of curious, how did you train for the Wainwrights? Like, was it any different than what you ordinarily do for doing something so big and so long and difficult?
Not a lot different. And to be honest, I've kind of moved away from even thinking of myself as training for things. And part of this has been working with my coach, David Roach, over the past few years and having a goal of really just maintaining my fitness as high as possible. And then leading up to an event, aiming that fitness or sharpening it just a bit for that particular challenge. So for this, going into it, I got some more steep terrain, a few big days in the mountains to kind of hone that fitness towards being able to deal with that amount of vertical. Of course, right now going into Hard Rock, I'm out here trying to acclimate to the altitude, which is a unique challenge for me. But really for the most part in training, my goal is to just maintain my fitness as much as possible throughout the year and be ready to adapt that to whatever comes my way.
That seems like a really good approach and a good way to keep yourself healthy. So you took 11 hours, I believe, off the previous time. Were you on that pace? Like, was that your original goal? Or were there moments where you were off your projected pace? Like, how did that unfold? Because this was like several days.
Yeah, so I originally had an extremely aggressive, ambitious goal of trying to go under 5 days. For these things that, as we've mentioned before, the logistics is particularly difficult, and especially if it's supported, because you have all these support runners coming out to meet you. You have people meeting you at various checkpoints along the way, and doing something that's this long and trying to tell someone, I'll be at this point at this time 5 days from now, that's quite difficult. And so I kind of had a buffer on my estimations. And so where I finished was around where that buffer was. And as I progressed and people watched my tracker, they could see where I was relative to my pace. But I did know as conditions evolved that I was going to kind of drop off that aggressive pace in some sections. Some of the earlier parts are quite technical and rocky, and it was a bit wet and claggy for those. And I knew there's just no way that I'm going to keep that pace going over wet rocks that early on. When I have no interest in injuring myself that with that much to go.
Right.
So, it's quite difficult to plan out those times, but you have to be willing to adapt and just accept that this is the pace that's comfortable, the pace that is going to enable me to have my best performance here, rather than trying to push through and injuring myself or burning myself out early on.
Yeah, that's definitely like the longer something is, the more of a consideration that is. And especially with juggling a support crew. I mean, I'm curious if you had any notable snafus with support, like maybe they weren't there at the right time or you weren't there at the right time, or was there anything like that that happened?
There was one spot where it was a support point that's a bit remote. It's a very, very small village that I passed through, and there was a bit of miscommunication as far as where the exact meeting point would be. So we missed the support for the next section. And fortunately, one of my support runners from the previous section was able to continue on with me. We were able to ration the food that we had left until the next group of support runners were able to sort things out and figure out where we were and meet us about halfway through that section. So that was definitely not as planned, but it all worked out. And, you know, those sorts of things add to the adventure a bit, as long as they do work out in the end.
Yeah, that's good luck that you had somebody with you that could continue on, and good that it worked out. I haven't really done much in the way of supported, but that's always like my fear when I consider doing supported. I'm like, I'm trusting somebody else is going to be where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there, and actually have, you know, if I have it myself, carry it with me, then I know it's there.
It's also, though, for me, a big source of motivation. I mean, before I came to the UK, I was more used to doing self-supported and unsupported things. And it really took me a bit of adaptation to accept the support when I came in and started doing these challenges. And I found that for me, when I'm out there in these terrible conditions at all hours of the day and people are showing up to help me, and when I get in a bad spot, I can't just quit. Like in my head, mm-hmm. these people are showing up to meet me at this tiny village at 2 a.m. in the middle of a horrible storm. I can't just let them be there and me not show up. So it works both ways and has been great to feel a part of that and really for these efforts to feel like a true team effort with the community pushing for these times to get as high, well, I guess as low as they possibly can.
That's really beautiful. I like that a lot. Like that feeling of community and being able to see it from both sides. So you kind of have mentioned the weather a couple of times. Can you talk a little bit about maybe the biggest weather challenge you faced during the Wainwrights? Was the weather you had what you expected?
From what I've come to expect from some of my previous challenges in the UK, the weather was quite nice. And for 5.5 days in the Lake District, I would never dare to hope for better. Like I said, there was some clag, there was some wet rocks I had to deal with early on, but I've been out doing these things before in the middle of named windstorms. I had nothing like that. My temperature mostly stayed in a pretty good spot, not too warm, not too cold. There was just one section where some rain did roll in. It got a bit nasty. I got a bit cold and wet. And I mean, to be honest, I would feel like I cheated if I didn't have at least one section like that in the Lake District. But it was tough more so because I pushed through it. It was later on. It was on the next to last day. And I pushed through it in order to get out of those conditions, in order to get back down to the checkpoint and to warmth, and pushing and kind of emptying my reserves there really depleted me to where when I did get to that next checkpoint, it took me a bit to recover, to warm back up, and to be able to get going on the next section at a good pace.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that happens to a lot of us when we're out there. I mean, you're almost in like a survival situation, or at least your body perceives that, and you push through things just fine. And then when you're finally safe or it's warm, then you actually feel much worse than you did when you were going through the thing that was so challenging.
Yeah. And in particular, it's highly likely, has been the case for me at least, that you didn't eat sufficiently during that stretch. Right. Because eating when it's wet and windy and cold, digging those things out of your pack, taking your gloves off, getting them opened, it's a pain. And kind of easy to ignore when there's something that's more important on your hierarchy of needs at the moment.
For sure. Yeah, I've definitely had situations where it's like battling hypothermia for hours and the end basically collapsing exhausted and then realizing, oh, well, you have been going hard and didn't eat or drink anything for the last like 6 hours. You know, it's like, yeah, you just don't think about that. You are just focused on getting through.
And eating helps keep you warm too. So that's, mm-hmm. again, where a good support crew can come in handy and keep reminding you of that and not take no for an answer when things get to that stage.
Like, I'm going to put it in your mouth if you don't eat.
Yeah. Yep.
So I'm kind of curious a little bit about the route finding and navigation for a route like this. I mean, obviously you had a route you were following, but did you use like regular maps? Did you have a GPS unit? Were you just using a watch? Were you relying on your support crew to help you with the navigation? Like, maybe a little bit about how that worked.
So I did have everything tracked out on GPX files to be able to follow. My support runners, most of them used that. Some of them prefer the map and compass, and some of them just know the area well enough that they kind of just don't need anything. Mm-hmm. And in those cases, I would largely defer to their experience and expertise there. There were a few times where I opted for something other than what my support runners were going for, taking a more direct line, or in some cases, one that avoided a bit of up and down at the expense of more distance. So the main thing on having support runners there for navigation is to relieve you of that mental energy. As we see it in things like Barclay, just having to focus on that and never having a second to let up and to relax, it really can get to you. So being able to kind of have this mental drafting, even if you know where you're going, enormously beneficial. And then the flip side of that, though, is there were times where I told my support runners, let me navigate for a bit, because I know that that's something that keeps my mind occupied and engaged. And if I'm in a point where I'm starting to fall asleep and really kind of drift out of it, then that's something that I know can help me. So that's where I would take over navigation and just tell them, you know, if I start to make a horrible mistake, then yell or throw something at me.
Yeah, it's very exhausting, the mental aspect, especially going into something that's days long. No mental break can be completely draining. And you mentioned sleep briefly there, where you're getting tired. So I'm kind of curious, since this was like a multi-day effort, how did you handle sleep? Like, what was your sleep strategy? And did it evolve and change while you were out there? Or did you have a plan and stick with it?
I did better on sleep than I expected to, honestly. It's something I've struggled with in the past on multi-days, particularly once you get well over that kind of 2.5 to 3 day mark. Like the first time I did Tour de Géant, once I got past 3 days, I was gone. I was taking constant dirt naps, stopping at every checkpoint to take a nap. I simply couldn't get through it towards the end. And so on this, I wanted to try as best I could to not let myself get past that sort of point of no return on sleep, where your debt just builds up so high that your body can't deal with it. So unlike, I think a common strategy on multi-days is to push through the first night and not sleep at all. I opted to go down for, I think I ended up sleeping about 40 minutes the first night, which fortunately I was able to get to sleep quickly. That's my biggest fear in trying to get sleep, is that I'll lay down and I won't fall asleep. And then I'm wasting time, which is, again, that's why dirt naps are so great. You know that you can fall asleep and you just do it right there, right then. But I got about 40 minutes that first night. And then the subsequent nights, or the middle nights, I had about 3 hours budgeted for it. And I would stop and eat and take care of my feet, anything else that needed done, tell my crew to wake me up after like 2.5 hours. But generally, I think every night I woke up around 1.5 to 2 hours. And at that point, I get up and I keep moving. And then the last night, I went back to just sleeping about 40 minutes. So all in all, I think I slept 8 to 9 hours over the 5.5 days. And there were only a few sections where I drifted into that just, I don't hallucinate. I've never hallucinated. I feel a bit jealous of people that I've got to have these experiences. But I get to this state where I just, like, it's athletic-induced narcolepsy is the best way I've thought of describing it. I can just fall asleep on my feet while I'm running. I can just hit the dirt and be gone. And so I only had a few sections where I had to battle through that.
I, too, tend to get the ultra-running narcolepsy, or whatever you called it. I have literally fallen asleep while moving and woken up on the ground. So we've known each other for a long time, and I've kind of seen your running evolve and change a little. And so I'm curious if you have a desire to continue exploring like very long, like multi-day FKTs like this, or maybe even longer.
I very much do. For me, always a trade-off of doing these challenges, having these big goals and these big experiences, getting to explore versus balancing that with my job and with my family. So there's definitely value I take from these things that apply to both of those. There's value in my kids seeing me take these on and accomplish these things and pursue my passions. But there's definitely a point of diminishing returns and a limit on that that I have to constantly evaluate. And so for me, like the AT has always been my holy grail. I would love to be able to take that on. But it's a matter of finding the time to do that around my job and family and other things. I mean, even the FKT, you know, that's a month and a half that you have to sit aside for doing that. So we'll see. We'll see where things go with my job, where my obligations land there, and how I can plan these things again, to have the family be a part of them, It was just it was awesome on the Wainwrights on the last day to have my wife and my kids were out there. They met me at various points along the route, both at checkpoints and up in the hills. My kids ran the final stretch with me to the finish. I had to tell them to slow down. I couldn't keep up with them at that point. So I mean, it's great to be able to do that, and so I'll have to constantly look at what I can do there and what fits in. But one day, I still have hope for the AT, at least to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I've really enjoyed is seeing how you integrate your family into a lot of your adventures. I have no doubt you will figure out a way to do the AT in the future.
Yeah, hopefully in the next few years. I will say after Hard Rock this year, I'm going to kind of with the move and everything else I've had going on, I'm going to take a stretch of smaller things, maybe going for the SCAR, the Smokies Challenge Adventure Run, which I held at one point in time and I lost it while I was in the UK, which is just a 70-mile stretch of the AT that goes through Great Smoky Mountain National Park right next to where I live. And so that one is quite meaningful for me. And then the latter half of this year, I might even just do a legit marathon build and see what I can do in that while I'm still able to do it before I get too old to run fast.
I think it is good and important to balance. You do an amazing job of balancing, but also just balancing like your actual athletic endeavors, like doing a marathon build, something a little different, giving your body and your brain a chance to rest from like the long things.
Yeah, and I actually think there's part of me that regrets not doing getting into ultras sooner than I did and kind of having a much longer window to be at the top of my game. I didn't start doing these at all until I guess I was 28, which is still much earlier than a lot of people have gotten into it. But I still look at that as how there were 5 or 6 years that I just missed. And even when I started, I was only doing it part time. But I look back at that now and I'm kind of like, maybe that was for the best. Maybe that's what allowed me to build my volume and to build my base in an effective and consistent and steady manner. Those years that I was splitting time between triathlon and ultra running and getting a bunch of aerobic volume on the bike, I think that that could really contribute to what has been for me possibly one of my greatest gifts in ultra running, in that I just haven't had any bad injury setbacks. I've been at this for nearly 10 years now with fortunately out any major injuries that have forced me to sit out and be sidelined for a while.
Yeah, injury and burnout are very real. And I think you can never know. You can't go back and see how things would have been different had you made other choices. But I definitely think that the more varied your training is, the better. I mean, you're definitely proof of that with, what you're talking about. I don't know that there's many runners out there who can say that they've gone 10 years without a major injury, especially doing things at like the volume and level that you have.
Well, and that's the other thing. I feel like since I started working with David, my volume has at least on in how many hours I'm putting into it has dropped. I mean, I typically peak at 70-ish miles per week, which is absolutely nothing compared to what you see other ultra runners doing. But again, there's kind of a total amount of stress that your body can take, and that's not just running. That's job and other life stresses taking into account, and with that factored in, that's basically been my peak. I do have one much bigger week coming up leading into Hard Rock, but that's atypical.
Yeah, I think that's something often that people overlook. And I know for me, when I was starting out in ultra running, I was kind of just surrounded by all these Bellingham trail runners doing 100 plus mile weeks, and all they did was run, and I'm trying to like emulate that. And for me, basically 70 is also my magic number. And it took me a long time and a lot of injuries to figure that out because I kept trying to be like emulating what I was seeing around other people. And I think that is something that comes with age and experience, is understanding your own body and your own formula for success. And it isn't a one size fits all.
Yeah, exactly. And that number, again, that's not much different than what a lot of serious marathon runners put in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's basically all of the questions I had for you. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about, either with the Wainwrights or upcoming goals or anything else you'd like to share?
I guess part of it for me is just considering what I want to do in the future going forward, split between races versus doing these FKTs and other challenges. I've really enjoyed having both over the past few years with COVID in particular. It's definitely been much heavier on the FKT side that I've been pursuing these things, and it's been exciting to see the community grow and to see the amount of effort and focus on some of these previously lesser known routes grow. So I'd like to continue doing these things, but I also hope that these can evolve into more than just FKTs. When I look at something like the Wainwrights or the Pennine Way, I don't want it to be viewed as kind of, well, you've got to try to get the FKT or the record or else it doesn't matter. Like these routes are so beautiful, and I want to see these FKTs bring attention to those routes and put it into people's heads to get out there and do these in whatever way suits them. The Wainwrights makes an incredible multi-day hike. Have a long distance through hike of it, stop in the villages along the way and take it at your own pace. And so I'd like to see some evolution in not just terms of the fastest known times on these routes, but seeing what we can do as far as all the known times of celebrating the people going out there and completing these challenges and adding their name to the list of people that have done that.
Yeah, absolutely. The value is in the journey, not in the time. So that's a great takeaway. So thank you very much for coming on the show today and chatting with us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks very much. I enjoyed it and look forward to hopefully seeing you again
Yes,
sometime
in
in the
person,
future.
maybe.
Yeah.
Yes. Thanks again, John, for coming on the show. You can check out his FKTs on the website, fastestknowntime.com, and follow him at Random Forest Runner on Instagram. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, this is Heather on the FKT Podcast.